Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my favorite green chicken in the whole wide world, and I mean that with all sincerity. His name is Doomberg. Doomberg, welcome back to the show, my friend.
George, it's a real pleasure to be back. If I'm your favorite, I'm probably also your least favorite because I'm sure we're in category one, but really great to be back on the show and looking forward to a really vigorous discussion as always.
Yeah, I really want to go over the last post that you did because this is a topic that's been on the forefront of my mind at least for the last couple of weeks, and that's the food shortage that we could be facing, not only in areas like Africa, in the poorer parts of Asia, but right in the United States. And I think, you know, I sent out a tweet the other day where I was thinking through kind of what it felt like in January of 2020, and even into February of 2020, regarding, we'll call it the cerveza sickness. And no one thought it could be real. Like, it was unimaginable. People thought that, well, yeah, okay, it's happening in China. Those things happen occasionally, but those things just never happened to the United States. And then when, you just did the numbers, you're like, well, okay, that might be true, but the probability of this becoming a global pandemic is extremely high once you kind of, you know, do some research here and think it through. And to me, what we're facing now with a global food shortage, it seems like the same type of setup, where Americans and most people in the West are saying, oh, yeah, food shortage, whatever. Yeah. That's never going to happen here. It's just, that's kind of something that other countries have to worry about. But then when you get into the actual data, think it through, do the math, you're like, no. This has an extremely high probability of coming home to roost, for lack of a better term there, no pun intended. So do you want to kind of go over a summary of your report, and then we can pull it up on the screen here and just go over it item by item?
You bet, George. And I would say, you know, maybe after we summarize the report, we can talk through some of the potential implications for U.S. and then foreign countries, because I do think they're slightly different, and I have a slightly different view than you do on how the U.S. will respond. But I do think in all scenarios, we're on the cusp of a pretty substantial crisis. And so what we did as a team is we actually spent a couple of weeks on the road, crisscrossing around the U.S. Midwest, talking to our pre-existing contacts in the agricultural space. As you know, we come from the commodity sector, and we have befriended farmers and brokers and people that, you know, trade and deal in the farming space. And we wanted to validate whether some of the things we were seeing on our Bloomberg terminal are manifesting in their real lives. And and it's pretty scary, the results that we found. And so what we did in the piece is we sort of made the point that, you know, in a financial crisis, the correlation of financial assets tends to converge to one. You know, everything goes down all at once. And on the bear market rallies, everything rallies at once. And we're seeing that same sort of convergence in all of the key inputs into farming here in the U.S., and there will be consequences in the U.S., but I think the real damage is going to be felt overseas as the U.S. responds in the way that we think it will. But in the piece, we just went through critical input by critical input and showed how basically they're all mooning. Supply is short, prices have exploded, availability is in doubt just as we're heading into the major planting season. All of this is disastrously exacerbated by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And while we have been accused of being alarmist by some of the critics to our piece, we would point out that, first of all, it's called Doomberg. And second of all, the mascot for Doomberg is Chicken Little. But in reality, we actually believe everything we wrote, and we've not yet seen a substantial rebuttal to the data that we showed. And so what we did was we walked through the major inputs into farming. And what are those? They are fertilizers, chemicals, diesel, machinery, labor, and then we concluded the piece with a prediction that we borrowed from Tracy Schubert at Chai Girl on the propane side of things, which is used for grain drying. But let's take them from top to bottom. So a key input into farming is fertilizer, and it's widely known by now that fertilizer prices have completely skyrocketed up 300, 400, 500% from just a year ago. And that's driven in large part by the natural gas crisis in Europe that we talked about before and that we've chronicled on Duberg many times. Natural gas is a key input into fertilizer, key input into ammonia. And then phosphorus is, you know, potash, it's mined. And you need fossil fuels to do that kind of mining. And then, you know, phosphorus is not potash, sorry, potash is potassium. It is mined, and then phosphorus comes, you know, from phosphates, and the Chinese, as we had documented, put an export ban. So if you just look at nitrogen, potassium, and phosphate, all three are under pressure for different but similar reasons. They're all sort of casualties of the energy crisis that started in Europe and leaked into China. And in particular, the Chinese, you know, limiting the phosphate exports when they did sort of seems to line up with when they might have winked to Vladimir Putin and said, go ahead and make a move on Ukraine, but we're going to go ahead and protect our domestic farmers. We flagged that in early October in a piece called Starvation Diet. So the perfect storm, which is the metaphor that we use to open that piece, is really laid bare here in the fertilizer market, where you see just over the weekend, Western European ammonia prices skyrocket from $1,200 a ton to $1,600 a ton when they were trading at $200 or $300 a ton last year. And those types of increases are just, they're just not palatable. They're just unacceptable to farmers that don't have the capacity to pay that price. And so what you're going to see this planting season, we think overseas, is a lot less fertilizer used. And that means a lot lower yields. And that really bodes poorly for the future, especially for countries on the brink. From fertilizer, we pivoted into chemicals, in particular herbicides. Glyphosate is the most widely used herbicide in the world, has a bit of a spotty track record from a toxicity perspective. It's linked to certain blood cancers, and it has long been the target of various environmental groups. Glyphosate, when you look at its chemical structure, it's got, you know, a nitrogen component that derives from ammonia. It's got a phosphorus component that derives from the same starting materials that are used to make fertilizer. And so its price has skyrocketed as well. China is the dominant producer of glyphosate today. And we, in the piece, we showed a chart of the price of glyphosate in China. It's up 3, 4, 5X again, like everything else that we're showing.
Yeah. I want to point out that one of the major inputs here is natural gas into nitrogen. Mm-hmm. And exactly. We all know who produces a substantial amount of the world's natural gas.
Indeed, and natural gas is a major input into diesel, which we pivoted to next. And of course, you need diesel to run your tractors and to run your heavy machinery on the farm. And you use natural gas to make hydrogen, which is used in the refining of oil to make diesel. Europe, in particular, imports both finished diesel from Russia and its partially processed oil precursor. And because natural gas spiked in Europe, the cost of producing hydrogen to refine oil to make diesel got out of hand, and diesel supplies are short in Europe, and that is causing global diesel prices to skyrocket. Even here in the U.S., we are not immune. Diesel, the average price for diesel retail is over $5 a gallon, and this is a significant penalty to truckers and farmers alike. Machinery itself is in short supply. The same chip crisis that has struck the automotive industry has laid bare the supply chain risks in the farming machinery sector. And in the piece, we quote from a farmer who is waiting on a $40 emissions chip to run his $250,000 tractor. And without that chip, the tractor is basically a $250,000 paperweight. This is becoming more and more of a problem. Both new machinery and used parts for used machinery are in short supply. And then we talked about the labor shortage. You know, the number of open jobs in the U.S. versus unemployed but willing to work continues to expand. There's a gap of 5 or 6 million, you know, vis-a-vis open positions relative to the number of people who are actually looking for work. And for farmers, this is particularly tough because of the physical nature of the work. Historically, a lot of this work has been served by immigrant labor. And with the border restrictions, with the disease that shall, or the virus that shall go unnamed, and the associated requirements to cross borders, that only makes the acquisition of suitable labor and willing labor more challenging. And then we closed it with propane. grain drying is a big part of the harvest process. You kind of want to harvest your crops a little bit wet, but then you need to dry them both for storage and for meeting the specifications for export and for sale. And you get docked if your crops are too wet. And some 80% of the grain drying in the U.S. is done using propane as a fuel, right, as opposed to natural gas, because most rural farms aren't connected to a natural gas pipeline. Mm. And we are exiting the winter season here in the U.S. with the lowest inventory of propane that we've had for at least 7 years. That's as far back as our Bloomberg terminal goes. And it's going to be a challenge. And so when you add it all up, you see that we are, you know, as we said, that the title of the piece is on the brink. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to fall over the brink, especially here in the U.S. But we are seeing, you know, at each of the critical inputs into the farming sector, substantial price inflation, well beyond what's measured by CPI, for example. And yes, grain prices are at record highs. And yes, farmers have crop insurance. And yes, maybe some of the farmers in the U.S. pre-bought their fertilizer or chemical needs for this season. And so they might have this season covered. But the real thrust of the piece is, regardless of how well we do here in the U.S., we're going to export this inflation in a very big way to parts of the world that literally can't afford it. And we predict, we don't suspect that we'll see food shortages here in the U.S., for example. You might see a few things missing from grocery shelves. You might have to buy different brands. It's certainly going to be a lot more expensive. But we do believe that farmers in the U.S. will be bailed out. Consumers struggling to make ends meet will get stimulus, especially in an election year. This will do nothing to dampen demand, but it will accelerate the food inflation that the rest of the world is going to experience. And so the real point of the piece is not to trigger panic in the U.S., but to just highlight that things are going to get more expensive. And for much of the world outside of the U.S., availability is going to be key. And we're going to see shortages and famine, we believe.
Yeah. So let's dive into that last part a little bit deeper. One of the things that, you know, when I first started getting into this at surface level, I thought, okay, well, how much grain do we actually consume? And if you don't directly consume wheat and bread, you know, is it a big deal? But then you kind of just scratch beneath the surface and you're like, well, wait a minute, this isn't just bread and Cheerios. Yeah. This is animals. This is protein.
Correct. And animal feed is the big conversion of this crisis into reality for most American consumers.
Right. So how does the United States sidestep this?
Well, I don't know that we can.
Well, I'm not talking about the inflation, the price inflation. I'm talking about them, you know, we in the 1970s, as an example, you had to wait in line just to get gas. Why won't we see that in the United States as far as food?
I think we're far more likely to see inflation than we are to see shortages here again. But here is a very small part of the world.
Oh, so I see. So your hypothesis is we're going to suck up all the food from the rest of the world.
Well, we're certainly going to be the marginal buyer at whatever the price is to clear the market. And then that price is going to set a price that is just out of reach for, you know, those are who are already on the edge in poor countries. And so in the U.S., our budget that goes towards food is small compared to the rest of the world as a proportion of our income. So the price elasticity of demand in the U.S. is such that we will be the price setters for the global market.
Right. Okay.
That's my theory. Now, good. Who knows? This is a very chaotic system. We are not that far away from export controls and price controls. And so who knows how that all shakes out? If you ask me today to predict it, I think, especially in an election year with the sitting president and ruling party behind in the polls, they will do whatever it takes to make sure there are no food shortages, including exporting inflation at record levels in those critical commodities. And so if the U.S. is going to be the incremental buyer, prices are set at the margin. Yeah. I don't think we're going to see food shortages here. I think we're going to see substantial spikes in inflation, which can be managed through, you know, stimulus and payments based on your income level to help offset the cost. We're already seeing that all over the country for gas. If they're going to do it for gas, you think they're not going to do it for food? Of course, they're going to do it for food. And so the last thing any ruling party wants is food riots. And as much as the existing Biden administration and their allies in Congress might care about other countries, it's probably a pretty good bet that they care more about their reelection than they do about what happens in some faraway land. And so that I think that we are going to be the marginal buyer. That price is going to be much higher than it is today. There will be some shortages here, but it'll be inconvenience. It won't be sort of starvation. But yeah. To the countries that are on the cusp that relied on Ukraine for imports or that could barely afford, you know, you're going to see weaker currencies. You're going to see empty shelves. You're going to see food riots. You know, the old expression is nine meals to crazy. You know, we're hope we're wrong. We ended the piece by saying like, we've never been more sure of something and never been more hopeful that we're dead wrong. We would be the happiest people in the world if our piece in hindsight was viewed as hyperbolic and incorrect. We take no pleasure in making this call. And in fact, we hope by writing the piece in our own small way, maybe we can affect some change so that we can avoid some of these most serious consequences, which would start by us getting a little bit more serious about our energy policy here.
Can you go into that? I know we discussed that on a live stream on the Rebel Capitalist channel, but for the George Gammon viewers, I think that's definitely worth diving into.
Well, I just think we have not yet experienced enough pain to snap our leaders into the seriousness of the fact that we are hurtling at 60 miles an hour into the brick wall of physics. I mean, energy is not doesn't appear from a magic wand. You can't create it from platitudes. If hot air was enough to power the economy, we'd be in an epic sea of abundance. But it literally, I mean, it has to be produced. It has to be explored for. It has to be developed. Capital needs to be deployed. Labor needs to work. And then the capitalists who took the risk to develop all of that and finance all of that need to be rewarded. So they keep doing it. And we live in this ignorance, this utopia of ignorance, where we just assume that energy materializes or that we can snap our fingers or wave a wand and provide the energy that's needed to sustain life, you know, just because we wished it or we willed it. This is not how the world works. And, you know, we've been screaming for a long time at Doomberg. We've been writing these pieces. We've been going on podcasts. We've been reaching out to politicians. Our pieces have been forwarded to members of Congress and their staff. These are very simple calculations. The laws of physics will not be denied. Energy is life. The amount of energy you produce dictates the integral of the standard of living that your population can enjoy. All humans would like a higher standard of living. When humans don't have a sufficiently high standard of living to meet Maslow's hierarchy of needs, they riot, and as they should. And so, you know, on the path from abundance to starvation is riot. And we're getting pretty close to the riot phase in many countries. I do believe that the political system in the US will react. Even Joe Biden and his inner circle, I believe, know the score. But we need to get serious about energy. We need to stop the nuisance lawsuits that are preventing, you know, natural gas pipelines that are 95% complete from reaching production. We need to understand that it is better to produce clean natural gas and domestic oil than it is to go begging Venezuela and Iran to fill in the gap that we have created by a de facto sanctioning of Russia. And by the way, we're not here to argue that sanctioning Russia is a bad idea. Sanctioning Russia without a plan to backfill it through domestic production that is secure and local is a bad idea. And we're about to find out who really holds the cards over there, you know? Until we still see unserious politicians on Twitter opposing domestic development of high energy efficiency, high energy return on energy invested fuel sources like nuclear and natural gas. And until we experience enough pain, these people are still going to have political sway. And it's a shame because we will eventually have to do it. Like there is no other solution. We will either have to do that or we will all have to suffer a far lower standard of living than is politically tolerable today. And so it's just frustrating. Like we wish we could skip all the BS and get to the answer. The answer is domestic energy production with full environmental protections, far greater environmental protections than you would find in the countries we're begging to produce today, which is the irony of all of this. You know, it's high time we stopped exporting our energy needs to dictators who don't like us.
You know what this reminds me of? I was listening to the Ice Age Farmer podcast the other day. And, you know, he's got his finger on the pulse of a lot of what's happening with the food shortages that we were talking about. And he mentioned a policy they have in Europe. I can't recall whether it was Germany or France, but they actually don't allow the farmers to utilize 100% of their farmland. Mm-hmm. And they pay them a subsidy. So what happens, they say, okay, you've got, let's say, 100 acres. We're only going to allow you to farm 50 of those acres. And it was a significant percentage as well. And then what we'll do is we'll just give you a government subsidy so you can go ahead and make ends meet. And even through what we've been seeing over the past month or two, the governments still haven't pulled back that policy and said, you know what, we're going to have a food shortage here. So why don't we go ahead and for this season, let you guys utilize 100% of your farmland. They still haven't done that yet. So my point there is, just like you're saying, we have to feel the energy pain. You know, at what point do we look ourselves in the mirror and say, okay, these policies just don't work no matter how good they make us feel. You know, when are we going to realize that food pain, either in Europe or in the United States, to the point where they say, okay, you know, this policy for climate change, it might make us feel good, but it's going to result in potentially hundreds of millions of people starving right now. We're not talking about death in the future, you know, 50 years from now. We're talking about next month. We're talking about in the next 6 months. And it's just unbelievable to me that they haven't gotten to the point in Europe where they're just allowing these farmers to utilize their land because it's not cool with the people who are against climate change.
Yeah, so this speaks to a broader point of if we're going to be in a war, we need to be in a wartime mindset. And as it pertains to the seriousness of both our energy and our food policies, it feels like, frustratingly, we have more pain to experience before we shock ourselves into the necessary wartime mindset. We put out a piece called Let's Get Serious About Energy a couple of weeks ago, where we laid forth what we think is a very sensible and logical plan for how the president should go forward, given the dislocation from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And you would think, like, politically, that Biden and his team would be all hands on deck for such an idea, because if we continue on the path we're on now, they're facing an epic wipeout in the midterms that we believe will cripple his presidency. So you would think at some point, political survival would dictate that you move on from the platitudes, open up a physics textbook, and understand what it is that you need to do. You know, when we get serious in this country, which is sort of why long-term I'm still, and the Newberg team is still pretty optimistic, we can move mountains very quickly like we did in World War II. You know, we went from not involved in the war to the decisive factor in less than 4 years. And the arsenal of democracy is still embedded in the DNA of the American worker. It just needs to be unleashed. The shackles of nonsensical regulatory barriers just need to be lifted. But the president is not there yet. So let's be totally honest. We are totally unserious still. And so ultimately, we've put out a few tweets that seem to get a lot of traction, simply retweeting a headline that says, more pain needed. We just need more pain. Because clearly, we are still in denial as to the magnitude of the crises that we see coming down the pipe.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. Yeah, I try to kind of use some game theory and put myself in the position of a politician. And there are no certainties, just probabilities. But I think one thing we can say with 99.9% certainty is the politicians are going to do whatever they think they need to do to get reelected. Let's just, you know, although as crazy as it may sound, if I try to put myself in the position of Joe Biden, or let's say the administration, you know, you've got this balancing act because you've got all these people that are going to vote for you that see natural gas, they see fossil fuels, let's mm-hmm. see, as the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. And anything you do, if it's turning on a pipeline or anything like that, results in the world ceasing to exist in 10 years. So you've got that constituency, and then you've got the constituency that's freaking out because, which is the majority of people, because food prices are going up. The problem they have is that the people in the first constituency can't connect the dots, right?
And they're not forced to, because they live a life of excess and privilege that the same people who are worried about the food prices going up have no.
Yeah, but from a psychological standpoint, yeah. How do you get that first group to say to understand that, yes, okay, climate change may be an issue, but that's in the future. And right now we've got a much, much, much bigger issue. And another thing, you know, I had a conversation with our good friend Art Berman the other day, mm-hmm. and we were kind of thinking through this, and I'm like, okay, let's just say that climate change is something that's going to negatively impact, or could potentially negatively impact, the world in 20, 30, 40 years. That's something that is a, you know, is it a 50% probability? Is it a 25? Is it a 10? We don't know. And what impact will it have? That's another unknown. But what is unknown is that if we make these energy decisions today, hundreds of millions of people will die. So what we're doing is we're rolling the dice and saying, let's just go ahead and kill 100 million people or more today, in hopes that you know, our fears are about the future, these unknowns, don't come to fruition. And to me, that makes no sense whatsoever. So psychologically, how do you how do you get those people to understand that this is the cost benefit analysis we have to go through?
Well, if there's anything that the last 2 years have taught us, it's that we as a society, and especially the subset among us that we would call the elite, who lord over us, we as a society and the elite who rule us are utterly incapable of doing cost-benefit analyses.
Yeah, right. Right.
And so to expect that we would be able to have a logical discussion to sort of change that when we've not yet seen the full consequences of what we've been warning about is a bit unrealistic. I think ultimately, like everything, it'll be too late. We will try all the bad things before we try the thing that we should have done, that we must do, when the pain has increased to the level where we realize, okay, something needs to be done. And I would say, sadly, that the death of 100 million people outside of the U.S. is not nearly as important to the political elite as the price of gasoline at the pump. Mm-hmm. And the price of the gasoline at the pump is far more likely to induce the type of change that we're hoping for than pictures of people starving in far off countries. You know, distance, there's a distance component to empathy. Yeah, right. You know, if that starving child was in the same restaurant as you, George Gammon, would pay for that meal. You would buy that child a meal. You would make sure they were nourished while they were in your proximity. But the proximity effect of ethics is one of the failings of humans. And if most of the damage is done over there, we're unlikely to internalize the true consequences of our own behaviors that might have caused that. And so the type, when we say, you know, more pain ahead, pain overseas is not going to impact this administration. Yeah, right. Pain domestically is what's going to impact this administration. So if we begin to see $6 and $7 and $8 gasoline prices, that's far more likely to trigger the type of political intervention and sanity check that we've been hoping for and writing about and advocating for several months than a mass starvation event in a far off country. And it's, look, it, I don't like having to say that. I just think that is the raw political analysis that needs to be said.
Do you think there's a possibility the administration will try to redirect that anger towards Russia in an effort to get the general population to support the United States going into a war that they know will make them more popular?
Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch for us. I do think that politicians have an instinct for what we call blame storming, where they get into a room and figure out whose fault it is, as opposed to actually trying to show genuine leadership and implement policies that will alleviate the problems. It's a bit of a stretch to think that because of political expediency, we will consciously provoke a war with a nuclear power. We're not ready to go there. I know many people assume that's what's going on. We were incorrectly skeptical that Putin would invade the Ukraine. I think the administration is trying its best to keep the war over there and have Russia punch itself out. We are far from geopolitical experts, as our call on whether Putin would invade proves. But we don't get the sense, and we would, it's just too difficult a concept to believe that we would want to provoke a war with a nuclear power for political expediency. That's a bridge too far for us.
It becomes a moral question, doesn't it? Because if you accept the fact that if the United States goes to war, it increases the probability of the politicians being reelected. If that is a fact, then the only thing that would prevent them from doing that would be their ethical line in the sand.
Yeah, again, I think that for us, I know many people ascribe to that belief, but that's, I don't want to live in that world where it's true. I think there are far better ways for them to secure the reelection than to risk nuclear annihilation. It's sort of Pascal's wager, George. I don't want to bet against the existence of God because it's just, I would just rather hold out hope that, and I do actually believe genuinely that nobody in the administration is looking to provoke a nuclear war with Russia over polling numbers.
What was the theory called?
Pascal's wager, where you stupid to bet against the existence of God, because if you're wrong, you're really going to get punished. Yeah.
I'll go with that for this one.
It's sort of a famous thought experiment in philosophy and ethics. It's kind of like Jim Cramer used to say, always buy the nuclear war dip, because if you're wrong, it doesn't matter what you own.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of shift the conversation to something that will, I hate to focus on the pain topic or theme here, but something I've been thinking about a lot is the yield curve and interest rates. And mm-hmm. I just did a whiteboard video trying to think through, you know, how high could the Fed raise Fed funds before things start to break in the economy, maybe in the stock market first, and therefore create more, you know, you're paying for not just the U.S. economy, but maybe the global economy. And it seems like the 2-year treasury is telling us the line in the sand is about 2%.
Well, it's an interesting thing, because you said something that I'm beginning to wonder about, which is, you said the Fed will raise interest rates. It seems like the market is kind of doing the tightening for the Fed.
At the long end, yeah.
Yeah. And also look at, I mean, the 2 years, not the long end. Or just take another example, forget government bonds, but the mortgage rates in the U.S.
Right, right.
The 30-year mortgage rate in the U.S. is it's pulling out. I think it's almost 5%.
Yeah, just last week, I know it was 4.77.
And so just breaking, pulling it up right now as we talk on our trusty boom, 4.56. I mean, this is up, 2x from just 6 months ago. It's kind of a straight line up since the beginning of the year. The Fed isn't raising rates at that rate. The market is, you know, and for the longest time, many in the sort of Austrian school of economics believe that the central banks have participated in suppressing interest rates, which is a sort of an artificial action that has caused a dislocation in the market. Well, at some point, the market, one of the theories of how this all ends is the market just takes back the wheel. And we see that in the 2 year, in the flattening of the yield curve. You know, I think it went negative today for the first time, which.
Yeah, and I think the 5 and the 30 went negative, didn't it?
A 210 for sure. But you know, if I pull up mortgage rates and you look at the 5 year chart of 30-year mortgage rates, it's gone completely vertical this year. And so it's in the face of a housing boom, you know, the first time home buyers, homes are sort of getting out of reach. And that is sort of the consequence of tightening, you know, the traditional rising interest rates diminishes economic activity. When we were at, you know, 3% on a 30-year mortgage just as early as September, and now we're at 4.5%, that's a substantial increase. And that's a substantial cost in a market where home prices have already appreciated to the point where first-time buyers can't get into homes. It's only been made harder, which means we think that, you know, the traditional analysis states that when the yield curve goes negative, I think the old adage is every recession has been preceded by a flattening of the yield curve or inverting of the yield curve, but not every yield curve inversion has led to a recession. So we're at that point right now where we're just beginning to invert, and rocky roads might be ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because at the end of the day, housing is just like the same dynamics with commodities, and it's just supply and demand. And we hear how supply is so limited right now, but you have to ask the question, how much demand destruction do we need to see in order for it to negatively impact the price? And there is a level where it will. And that's kind of a thought experiment that I went through. You know, if rates, I think the numbers I used were 2.7 and then 6.5, because we're already at 4, or we were at 4.77 when I did the whiteboard. And if you're someone that can afford a $2,000 a month mortgage at 2.7%, you can afford a $400,000 house, roughly. At 6.5, you can only afford a $275,000 house. That's a big, that's a lot of demand destruction.
Yeah, you know, interesting counter or maybe alternative view, I'm sure you know, or maybe have seen, but Jim Bianco put out a really great 21-part tweet thread yesterday morning. You know, I'm sure you know Jim, right?
And sure, yeah.
Twitter, yeah. He put a really great thread out called "Why Do We Have Inflation and Why Is It Persistent? And Why Will the Fed Have No Choice But to Address the Problem?" And he makes some pretty compelling points that the true economic changes and the permanence of those changes that result from our response to the virus that shall go unnamed, lest we demonetize George Gammon's podcast, has not really been internalized by economists. And his main point in that piece is that the work from home, remote work trend is not going to reverse, and that we're not actually going to go back to commuting to go work in an office, that the hysteresis effect of that experiment is semi-permanent, and that the consequences of that is a potential sustained bid under durable goods like housing in a way that the Fed is going to have to act sort of historically to try to get back under control. And so it's a really thought-provoking thread. I would encourage the listeners to go and find it. I think if you just search persistent for, at Bianco Research, it'll come up in your Twitter feed. But it was a really thought-provoking thread. And one of the beauties of Twitter, of course, is you have all these great minds with decades of experience pontificating about these macroeconomic trends in ways that can teach and inform.
Yeah, there's one thing we can all agree on, and that is the government intervention and how heavily it distorts the economy. And I mean, a great example is that report, that article you just did on the food shortages and how mm-hmm. there's all these inputs that we don't even think about. Everything from nitrogen to potassium to potash, all the way to propane, you know, for drying the grains and whatnot. I mean, and you just adjust one thing, you know, a central planner comes in and just does one thing to try to pander to a political base by saying, oh, no, you can only use, let's say, you know, 80% of your farmland or something like that. And it has this ripple effect throughout the entire economy that absolutely no one could predict. But it seems like the central planners and these politicians just layer these bad decisions with unintended consequences on top of each other. You know? So yeah. It's like, what do you think the next bad decision? Oh, well, let's discuss that, because you talked about the administration. I know they're trying this in Quebec. I think that, what's his name in California? The used car salesman, Newsom.
Yeah.
He talked about this, and I heard Biden talk about this at a global level for helping out countries in Africa, how we're just basically going to give them money. And it's as if inflation, consumer price inflation, can be solved with more money instead of more supply, right? So what chain reaction, what unintended consequences do you will result from this other than just price inflation?
Yeah. So concurrent with that, though, I will say that sort of would fall into the category of managing to the optics.
Right.
And so, you know, and that's fine. And you understand that that sort of is part of the politics game. But I do think it is important to give the Biden team some credit for the deal they struck in Europe on forming a joint task force to explore ways to increase the U.S.'s capacity to export liquefied natural gas to Europe to make up for any potential or future shortfalls that Vladimir Putin might decide to expose the Western Europeans to. And so, you know, and we've been advocating for this for a long time. And we think that ultimately, when the Biden team, you know, came back from Europe and begins to study this issue, they're going to see that there are some pretty simple things they can do to substantially accelerate this, like getting a task force on regulatory acceleration, approving the projects that are already done, reconsidering the Keystone Pipeline fiasco in Canada, and so on and so on. And it wouldn't take much to unleash the full power. So, you know, to pivot this conversation to a bit of optimism, the US is the most capable in the world of turning the energy on. We have incredible technologies, really great companies, true patriots working at those companies that have long been requesting and lobbying for nothing more than the right and the ability and the protection of the government to produce the critical energy that we need, and to maybe stop alluding to the fact that these people are criminals. I mean, there was at one point, I mean, even Biden himself, like during the campaign before he was elected, made reference to the fact that criminal charges weren't out of question for fossil fuel executives for the quote unquote damage they've done to the planet.
And now the windfall profit taxes.
And, you know, it requires some political courage, which unfortunately has been in shockingly short supply. And by the way, both parties are guilty in some ways, not to just sort of be trying to be neutral for the sake of it. But it's time we all got together. We all got serious. And we said, hey, the Mountain Valley Pass pipeline, which is 95% complete, which was approved years and years ago, which suffered another bureaucratic setback this year, and a three-panel judge, you know, of Clinton appointees and Obama appointees revoked their previously issued permit and left that whole project in limbo. Maybe we want to just sort of pass an executive order or get a quick law passed where we just approve that and we get that going, because, you know, that limits the amount of natural gas that can be lifted out of Appalachia, which, you know, puts constraints on our ability to help our European allies, and also results in higher prices outside of Appalachia. Ironically, it results in lower prices in Appalachia, because if gas can't leave, then kind of have to sell it for what they can get it for. But a task force of industry executives that know what they're doing, that know what they need, they can certainly be unleashed very, very quickly. And so to the end, you know, at the end, when we say more pain needed, we know what the answer will be. The only real question is how much pain do we truly need to suffer before we convince those who can't yet see what's going on, what needs to happen.
Yeah, great point. So you're really neck deep in commodities. And one of the things that I've been trying to think through over the past month or so is commodity super cycles. And I looked at a chart, you know, going all the way back, I think into the 1800s. And you see these super cycles just happen over and over and over again. And there's actually many cycles within, I would call them a mega cycle. And I can't recall the mega cycle, you know, like 40, 50 years. And then you have these smaller, I guess, call them super cycles within those mega cycles that seem to last about 10 or 15 years. And the last one that we had, I think, went from about 1996 to roughly 2011 or so. And it just seems to me that we might have started another super cycle in March of 2020, or basically whenever oil got to negative $38 a barrel. What are your thoughts on that? And I'm sure you've done a ton of homework on commodity super cycles.
Yeah, commodities undergo these super cycles because of the length of time it takes for supply to respond to high prices.
Yeah, right.
And that's not the type of technology that is susceptible to, you know, Moore's Law, for example, the famous doubling time exponential growth of computer chips. And so the greater the disparity between supply and demand, the greater the sort of snapback in prices. But the concept of a commodity super cycle is a bit challenging because sometimes when you have true crises and prices really skyrocket, you see destruction of demand and economic collapse. And so when you look at the last time that the price of oil was over $150 a barrel, what happened is very quickly we had the global financial crisis. Now, we catch a lot of heat on Twitter for connecting those two, you know, correlation is not causation. If energy is life and the cost of energy triples, you have a lot less life. It's just the way it goes.
Or GDP. And,
right? Yeah, exactly. Well, GDP, you know, standard of living, however you want to measure it. There's a whole cascading series of economic activities that just cannot occur at $200 oil or $300 oil. So there is a price at which energy super cycles, commodity super cycles, and they're highly interrelated, of course, because you need energy to produce commodities. Commodities are nothing more than stored potential energy. You know, there comes a point where if the velocity of the disparity between supply and demand is so high, it tends to fix itself. And the fix to that is demand destruction and economic depression. And nobody wants that. So, you know, there are ways to, and again, there are two sides to the commodity super cycle, which is demand shock and supply shock. And right now we're kind of pushing both. You know, we're coming out of the lockdowns, the sort of pent up economic, the human spirit that has been locked down for 2 years wants to live again, wants to go back to the old ways and wants to travel and wants to see the world and wants to produce and wants to work. That's being, you know, rubbed up against the constraining supply because of a combination of regulatory environmental policies, but also, to be totally fair, the fact that the energy industry destroyed a lot of capital during the shale boom, and perhaps the investors in those companies would like to see a little bit of return on cash. And so all of these are sort of conspiring to make the disparity between supply and demand quite large, but we would caution that the longevity of that super cycle will be self-correcting because ultimately, you know, you can't have economic growth without energy growth. And there's just a whole series of economic activities that can't happen at $200 oil.
Yeah, it just makes you wonder on the demand side, can they kick that can down the road further with, let's say, stimulus checks or universal basic income, government deficit spending, whatever you want to call it. And then on the supply side, do we have a fix as quickly as we normally would due to high prices because of the ESG movement? It's almost like you've got this what do they call it? An immovable force and an unstoppable or unstoppable force and an immovable object type of thing.
Yeah.
It's like you've got that ESG pushing on, and then you've got prices of commodities pushing on the other side. And it's like, how high do the prices have to go in order for them to overwhelm kind of the ESG movement to where the people just kind of, and the politicians and that constituency kind of waves the white flag. And then you couple that with the demand side of the equation, maybe not going down as fast because the government's willingness to send out stimulus checks or UBI, it seems like it might be a little different equation. It's not different this time, but the equation might be slightly skewed.
Yeah, again, anytime you sort of perturb a nonlinear system, it's very, very difficult to understand how the full sort of game theory consequences of these things will play out. And you know, it kind of feels like we've started these experiments and we just kind of have to react to the events as they unfold. It's many things we've seen this year would have been very difficult to predict a priori. They're kind of easier to retroactively explain, but we're going to see a lot more of that going forward, unfortunately, we think.
All right, my friend, we'll leave it there. Please tell all my listeners and viewers how to find out more about what you do and go to your Substack and Twitter and anything else that you've got going on.
You bet. So you can follow us at Doomberg T on Twitter, Doomberg T as in team. You can follow us on Substack at doomberg.substack.com. And George, it's always a pleasure to be on your show and looking forward to coming back.
Yeah, great. Have a good one, man.
You too, brother.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.